The North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our audience of blind and print-impaired people. I'm John Federson, and I'm reading this week's issue of Indie Week. The issue, dated May 11th, 2023. As always, we switch between the print edition of the Indie Week and the online IndieWeek.com, which has a one-day later datelines for some of their articles. The first one, though, in the print edition by Jasmine Gallup from Wake County, Election Exhaustion. Last month, Republican lawmakers scored a major victory in their years-long campaign to restrict voting rights when the NC Supreme Court ruled in favor of gerrymandering, voter ID, and a law that denies parolees their right to vote. Meanwhile, these same lawmakers are ignoring the fact that the only legitimate attacks on elections are coming from within their own political party. Ever since 2020, when former President Trump falsely declared the results were rigged, claims that election results are illegitimate have been on the rise. In 2022, several prominent North Carolina Republicans who denied or cast doubt on the results of the 2020 presidential election, including U.S. Senator Ted Budd, were elected to office. This year, two members of Surrey County Board of Elections were dismissed from their posts after refusing to certify local elections in November. Caitlin Kaiser, a voting rights lawyer for the Southern Coalition of Social Justice, says, "From the 2020 election and even to 2022, we see this continued disinformation about the process itself." She says, like voters receiving calls that election day is not today, or that they need to turn in their absentee ballot on a day that's not election day. For the past few years, local boards of elections have also been under heightened scrutiny. Some workers have received threats, while others have been assaulted by so-called poll watchers. Gary Sims, who has served as the director of Wake County Board of Elections for 8 years and is set to retire at the end of this month, can attest to the phenomenon personally. Sims, who's been in the business for more than 20 years, says, "The world we live in has changed when it comes to elections. After 2020, who would have thought? I had to call the police on somebody for trying to break down the front door of my house. I have an armed officer every day in my office. We have to get to our board members now to park behind barbed wire fences when they come to board meetings." In the meantime, the Elections Department has also been swamped with public records requests, mostly from extreme conservatives, who have outright stated on websites or social media their goal is to impede the work of election officials. Sims says their requests are intentionally designed to bog down elections people. "We have a network that follows and monitors their Telegram groups and conspiracy websites. That's where they say, okay, here's our next action item. Start plastering your county boards with this." He adds, "People are basically copying and pasting these public records requests. It's not a matter of, hey, can you send me this? It's just so voluminous what they're asking for, and you can't get to the next record because you're still dealing with the one you got. We see 5 or 6 pop up in one day sometimes." He says the intent of these requests is absolutely obstructive. Many of them are mapped out by conspiracy theorists like MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell, who is infamous for denying the results of 2020. Lindell is now being sued for defamation by Dominion Voting Systems and has been ordered to pay $5 million in an election fraud challenge with which he has so far refused to comply. The influx of public records requests, which in Wake County grew from 16 in 2018 to 60 in 2020 and 171 in 2022, has had the intended effect. Managing these requests has become a full-time job, prompting Wake County to hire a new public records coordinator last year, Danner McCulloch. And McCulloch says there's so much that goes into administering elections, and just receiving all these requests every day, whether they're small or large. We have to keep everything on track. It does take a team. Conspiracy theorists and disinformation aren't the only new challenges elections administrators are facing. Elections changed drastically during COVID pandemic when staff had to figure out how to get people to the polls safely, and again after it subsided when the rates of early voting and mail-in ballots skyrocketed. In 2020, 83.5% of the 5.5 million North Carolinians who voted did so either early or by mail. That's a big jump over the roughly 66% of voters who voted early or by mail during 2016. And the trend has continued. In 2022, the majority of North Carolina voters, 58%, continued to vote early or by mail. That's slightly more than the 54% who voted early or by mail in 2018. These jumps do not come without cost. With inflation on the rise, Wake County Budget Director David Ellis recently estimated that the Wake County Board will spend an additional $32,000 during 24-25 fiscal to mail out absentee ballots and other voter materials. The cost of running elections is on the rise, and some county departments are struggling to keep up. A recent report from the Southern Coalition for Social Justice reveals that some county departments of elections in North Carolina have seen a consistent decline in funding, including Cumberland, Richmond, and Onslow counties. Others remain underfunded in the face of growing populations, despite regular increases to their budgets. Even Wake County, which currently has the highest election department budget in the state, over $10 million, could use a few thousand dollars more for four or five additional staffers, according to Sims. In terms of funding, the Wake County Board of Commissioners has been supportive of the elections department, says Sims, but he and others are still trying to get hundreds of thousands of people to the polls, produce more than 100 different types of ballots, and audit hundreds of campaign finance reports, all with about 40 full-time employees. Sims says we have to be very efficient in what we're doing once we get to election time, when we go to a 7 days a week operation with 14 or 15-hour days. You want to make sure you're not working your staff into a burnout situation. I'm not saying I'm properly staffed, but I think if you ask anybody in any department, people are the number one need. Wake County's Elections Department, according to Sims, has not experienced a higher-than-average turnover rate due to burnout, but the same cannot be said for others, more rural election departments. Earlier this year in Virginia, an entire county's election staff quit amid false claims of voter fraud. In the effort to keep elections free and fair, funding county election departments is the key. The report from the Southern Coalition for Social Justice highlights a slew of practical concerns for election directors and need to update voting machines so they don't fail on election day, a need for in-house tech support to manage the computers, printers, and other technology staff regularly use during elections, and a need for more office space. But in addition to those practical concerns, the report also highlights larger problems, one of which is a need for livable wages for election and poll workers, according to Kaiser. Quote, we're seeing this trend in North Carolina of experienced and trusted election officials leaving because of the stress and the burden and the fact they don't have a livable wage for their family and themselves. Most election directors also expressed frustration at the rise of election denier conspiracy rhetoric, adding that the lack of voter education exacerbates the spread of conspiracy theories, states the report. In the counties where elections budgets are being reduced, quote, that decline in funding is directly related to voter experiences, says Kaiser. For voters, that could mean driving 45 minutes to an early voting site, waiting in long lines, casting ballots on outdated equipment, or being confused about when, where, and how to vote. Not many people pay attention to the amount of money being given to their county board of elections, but it's essential. Research from the Southern Coalition for Social Justice has shown a correlation between the amount of money spent on elections and voter turnout. Kaiser says, we've seen, for example, Onslow County actually had one of the worst voter turnouts in 2022, and they also spent the least amount of money on elections per voter. That ties into counties not having many voting sites, or having extremely long lines on election day, or not having accessible information about voting. It creates a climate where voters feel like, what's the point? This is not an easy process for me. It's to that end that the Southern Coalition for Social Justice is trying to mobilize people to advocate for more election funding, says Kaiser. Quote, we have people who are engaged, who are wanting to ensure that elections are free and open and transparent and participatory. Our whole goal with doing this research is to engage people and provide transparency, to say there is something that we can do. We can continue to advocate for particular budget line items that impact the community and build a stronger understanding about why election budgets are so essential. If given more money, many election directors talked about, quote, better engaging the public through more voter outreach and education. According to the report, quote, directors almost always mentioned their desire to launch innovative programs to encourage the public to learn more about the work of elections officials, advertise elections in public spaces, and make the entire election process, voter registration, in-person voting, and absentee voting, more accessible for all. They cannot further reach the public and achieve these goals due to their lack of funding. Well, I try as best I can now. I'm going to alternate my article choice from depressing and discouraging to uplifting and hopeful. And one of my hopes is that there's enough hopeful articles, and here's one from Durham. Jenna Smith writes, for the birds. At a Durham City Council meeting, you can expect to see a diversity of ethnicities, genders, religions, and opinions in the audience. Last month's meeting also included a diversity of species. Hand-painted bluebirds raised on wooden sticks sat interspersed among the audience members, making a special guest appearance. The birds in question? Artistic representation of the 160 great blue herons and great egrets who have built a home in northeast Durham. In the halls of City Council on the first night in May, the birds' future was decided. In a 4-2 vote, the council voted to assign 215 acres of city-owned property to a dedicated nature preserve, ensuring permanent protection by the state of North Carolina. The Ellerbeek Watershed Association, a nonprofit environmental organization based in Durham, proposed the measure, along with the NC Department of Natural and Cultural Resources. The two groups have pushed to protect this city-owned parcel of land, one of the few sites in North Carolina's Piedmont region where great blue herons and great egrets nest. During the meeting, five passionate advocates took the stand to argue for permanent protection, and four others joined via Zoom. Passion for this cause extended beyond the podium. Throughout the evening, as the audience waved their illustrations of those great blue herons mounted on sticks, council members described being inundated with emails calling for a dedicated nature preserve for the rookery. Durham resident Benita Green said on Zoom, we need all those plants, all the wildlife, all the biodiversity to continue to live. It needs to be dedicated as a preserve so we can preserve the wildlife for the animals as well as for humans, for our physical and mental health. Council members were united on the importance of the land's preservation. Mayor Pro Tem Mark Anthony Middleton said, the question is not whether or not we should protect it, but how. Throughout the meeting, environmental jargon flew through the air, representing a fundamental conflict. City staffers proposed the creation of a city-controlled registered heritage area to protect the rookery, while the environmentalists proposed a dedicated nature preserve through the state natural heritage program. Both dedicated preserves and registered areas advance conservation efforts and protect regional biodiversity. David Fleischer, a city General Service Department representative, said a dedicated nature preserve designation cannot be undone. He said it is truly permanent and perpetual. The only instance in which it could be undone is an act of the governor and council of state, he said. Didiana Freeman, council member, advocated for that dedicated preserve throughout the meeting. She said this council has been responsible for building in a wetland numerous times, so the permanency of having state protection in place feels like we're working toward climate resilience and not against it. Some notable dedicated preserves in North Carolina include Eno River State Park and Jordan Lake Game Lands. Contrastingly, a registered heritage area can be undone at any point by the city council. Some local registered heritage areas include Duke Forest and Bennett Place Forest. Proponents of Ellerby Creek proposal urged the council to pursue state protection. Local resident Dave Connolly, there is protection and there's permanent protection. The staff's recommendation is reasonable and should be good enough for today, but might not necessarily protect the egret sanctuary for the future. Ricky White, executive director of Ellerby Creek Watershed Association, said more funding is available to dedicated sites than registered sites. He also attempted to ease concerns regarding state involvement. Permanent protection, he said, doesn't mean the state can then do random things to the property. It just means the state can monitor the activities, and if it's not being conserved, then they can act legally to enforce that. In order to accommodate infrastructure concerns, the proposal was amended prior to the meeting to allow for an 800-foot-wide carve-out for future parkway construction. During Monday night's discussion, Councilmember Jillian Johnson raised other questions regarding the impact of the new designation on future Durham development. In response to questioning by Johnson, Fleischer noticed the vast majority of the area in question is not developable, because it sits on a floodplain. Of the 215 proposed acres, he said, only a small, about 30-acre section could potentially be developed. Council members Johnson and Middleton voted no on the proposed motion. Middleton says, I think we're all committed to preserving this land, no controversy there, but I can't support this motion tonight. I think there are too many unanswered questions. We can achieve protecting this land and the birds without moving with lightning speed tonight. In the end, the motion moved forward, and the council reached what Mayor Elaine O'Neill described as a step one of a long process of ensuring protection for the city's winged residents. Next, from Durham, Jeff Billman writes about the HEART, H-E-A-R-T model. It's poised to expand. What are city leaders willing to pay for it? So I'll have to abridge this radio article for, let's just call it inappropriate language, so you'll hear a lot of initials. The man lay shirtless on a red couch, clutching a screwdriver and a crack pipe. He warily eyed the visitors, shuffling into his dark living room. What's going on? Asked one social worker, Jessica Laub. Effing up, he said, every GD day, effing up. He already knew, Laub and her two colleagues, peer support specialist Samantha Cutler and paramedic Allison Casey. The three wore the teal T-shirts of the Durham Community Safety Department's 10-month-old HEART program, which dispatches unarmed responders to low-risk 911 calls police once handled. They had been to his house many times before and were familiar enough that he asked them to tidy up, pick up clothes off the floor, find the TV remote. But he was still suspicious. "Why are you sitting so close together?" he snapped at Laub and Cutler. When he gets high, he gets paranoid and imagines intruders lurking in his home, so he calls 911 and keeps calling. He'd already called several times this April morning. He's one of Hart's most frequent neighbors, to use the program's term. Cutler was frustrated. The man had recently, finally, checked into rehab, but he walked out within a week. Cutler said, sounding not unlike an exasperated parent, "You want to be paranoid, because if you didn't, you wouldn't pick up. I've been there, done that." Her job is to connect with people in crisis. "It took 16 years for me to get clean," Cutler told him. "It's not easy, but it can be done because I did it. And if I did it, you can too." "I really do hate it," the man said. "Every day I do the same bull." "Doesn't have to be this way," Lauber says. "It don't, but easier said than done." "Well, next time you go, stay your ass there," Cutler said. "It's that simple." He did go back, but he didn't say stay. 5 days later, he called 911 35 times, Cutler told me with a sigh, but he's still alive. Part of Hart's role is to reduce potentially dangerous interactions between law enforcement and people with mental health or substance abuse issues. Durham officers have killed 8 people since 2013, at least 3 of whom were in a crisis. A few months ago, a young officer had fatally shot this particular man's dog while responding to a 911 call. "We only had 3 buckets to put 911 calls, police, fire, and EMS, said Durham Community Safety Director Ryan Smith, but there's a whole bunch of other reasons people call 911, and a lot of those calls have historically been sorted into the police bucket. A lot of calls we can safely and appropriately respond to without sending law enforcement. Without sending, you know, someone armed with a weapon. Durham established the Community Safety Department on July 1st, 2021, 13 months after George Floyd's murder sparked a national movement to defund police departments. Reform efforts were already breaking against the rocks of rising crime, and the Durham City Council's plan to eliminate vacant police positions to fund this new effort became a flashpoint in acrimonious fall elections. But the department inched forward, launching its flagship program, the Holistic Empathetic Assistance Response Team, HEART, on June 28, 2022. There is no other like it in North Carolina. HEART is still in pilot phase, with its teams covering only a third of the city for about half the day. But the program has already diverted more than 2,000 911 calls from law enforcement. That's about 7 per day. And Durham officials appear to consider it an unequivocal success. There's no longer a debate about whether it should grow. As City Manager Wanda Page prepares to propose her budget to the City Council on May 15th, coming right up, the question is how big, how quickly, and how to pay for it. A citywide 24/7 expansion would require significantly increasing the department's $4.8 million budget. That's no small lift for a fast-growing city with pressing needs, yawning economic disparities, and a stubbornly high murder rate. Though 20% of police department positions are unfilled, Durham is unlikely to raid the police budget to expand HEART. Even in North Carolina's most progressive city, defunding the police is politically toxic. Jillian Johnson, council member, says people get really intense about the idea of taking anything away from the cops. Johnson, who previously advocated reducing police funding, now says she doesn't care where Hart's money comes from, only that it comes. Other officials, including Smith and Police Chief Patrice Andrews, are careful to portray the police and HEART as complementary, not competitive. And Smith said, "What we've demonstrated in Durham is you can do this work with integrity, with the purpose for which it was envisioned, and you can do that work in a way that does not have to be antagonistic with law enforcement." Activists have held rallies to support the program. yard signs. Expand the Heart program have popped up all across the city. Mark Anthony Middleton, Durham's mayor pro tem, said the narrative of the police versus Heart has existed more in the political arena for those who want to create tension than it has in the actual working arena of those departments, he said. Community Safety Department has marketed itself as well, hosting an open house in City Hall and screening a documentary, touting its work to a packed downtown theater. But its promotional campaign seems less about lobbying for funding than about evangelism. Though young, building the plane as we fly it is a common refrain. Heart ranks among the country's most ambitious alternative response programs. It will also be the most intensely studied, as research teams from Duke University's Center for Social Equity and the Research Triangle Institute track the program's first 3 years. Heart's public dashboard also provides detailed statistics on that work. Anise Vance, Assistant Director of Community Safety and formerly the city's Chief Data Officer, says Heart is a demonstration project not only for the state, but the country. She said, you can have a nonviolent, holistic response to public safety that is effective and keeps your workers safe as well as the folks in your community, and people in the community will support it. Eugene, Oregon, launched the first unarmed response program in 1989. By 2019, CAHOOTS, Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Street, CAHOOTS, was handling 10% of 9/11 calls that would have gone to law enforcement. It saved the city about $14 million in emergency medical services. The idea quickly spread after George Floyd's death. Since 2020, at least 19 of the country's 50 largest jurisdictions have established unarmed response programs, according to the Brennan Center for Justice. Durham was already moving in that direction. In 2019, the City Council created a task force to develop viable alternatives to policing. Amid demands to slash DPD funding a year later, city officials promised to form the Community Safety Department. The council's progressive bloc said they'd shift funds from 60 vacant police positions to jumpstart the new department. But in May of 2021, with homicides rising and residents calling for more cops, the council agreed to eliminate, instead of 60, 5 police vacancies. Middleton argued that transferring more positions would have been theater. We can create positions out of thin air if we want. And my question was, why would we want to place community safety in its infancy in the same position we criticize the police department for being? That's having a bunch of unfilled positions just for the sake of posturing, so we can say to the country, we're defunding the police. Indeed, it's not clear how community safety would have accommodated 60 additional people when Smith hadn't figured out what it would look like. Something like Eugene's CAHOOTS, which sends a social worker and medic to low-risk calls, was one of many possible options. So were co-response models, partnering police with mental health professionals that are standard in the United Kingdom and Canada. Atlanta's program reaches out to individuals experiencing homelessness, addiction, or mental health issues. San Francisco's Home Team provides services to repeat 9/11 callers. Tucson, Arizona separates 9/11 calls related to mental health issues from the rest. To Smith, these programs were pieces of a larger idea, so he and his team divided Heart into 4 segments: community response, which is the unarmed crisis teams; co-response, which pairs a police officer and mental health clinician; crisis call diversion, in which a clinician in the 9/11 center assesses mental health-related calls; and care navigation, which follows up with the people Heart teams encounter. Only Albuquerque, New Mexico's program is as expansive. They also set out to determine which calls Heart's responders should take suicide threats, welfare checks, public intoxication, behavioral health problems, and trespassing, yes. Anything with a weapon or threat of violence, no. Smith tweaked the response model in ways both subtle and significant. Hart staffers work for the city rather than a private contractor. That's a common practice, so they can't refuse calls that fall within the program's criteria. Hart responders are also dispatched to more types of calls than teams in many similar programs, and they can enter people's homes, which some cities prohibit. Importantly, Smith added peer support specialists to community response teams, which have often comprised two members. The specialists include people in recovery or who have lived unhoused in Durham and understand social service systems that often seem opaque and inaccessible. That has been essential to building trust, he said. Quote, one thing our residents want when someone replies to a 911 call, they want someone who knows the community well, who may have relevant lived experience. They have a deep level of empathy and understand what this is like. There was never any doubt that Smith would be the Community Safety Department's first director. As head of Durham's innovation team, Smith spearheaded projects to expunge criminal records, restore suspended driver's licenses, and help people with criminal histories secure jobs. He also coordinated the city's response to the pandemic. His reputation for grounding ambitious policies in data suited a progressive technocratic government. But Smith was cautious about navigating the political terrain. After he became director in July 2021, he declined my request for access to report on the department as it took shape. Quote, I was very nervous about the prospect of having someone in the room. It felt like it was a time of great scrutiny, he explained to his staff. That's no longer a concern. After all, Smith had invited me to this meeting. Just shy of its first birthday, Hart is both a fixture and an outlier in City Hall. It's a family of idealists within a bureaucracy. They've developed their own language and customs, adopting Smith's fondness for multicolored post-it notes that line the office walls, some with information about support services, others containing aspirational notes about Hart's future. Every team member is assigned a bird nickname. Smith is Chief Chickadee, Vance is Pigeon, and Laub is Flamingo. The names originated when Smith was designing an organizational chart and felt uncomfortable with titles like Clinical Manager 1 and Clinical Manager 2, too hierarchical. Someone suggested Sparrow and Dove as placeholders. When they hired, the nickname stuck. As the department grew, the bird theme was part of the culture. Using the word neighbor was more deliberate. The common words that we often hear in this area are clients or consumers, Smith said. None of those felt right to us. Someone brought forward the suggestion of neighbor, and it just felt like it embodied the spirit of the work and how we want to be thinking about it. That concept drives Hart's hiring, he added. Quote, what many, maybe all of us, have experienced in life is we're walking downtown, we see someone in crisis, and the instinct is to go the other side of the street, stay away. What we're looking for are people who will draw near to people at that moment of crisis, that sense of physical proximity, of not othering or judging or being afraid. That, to me, is what is embodied by the term neighbor. The children's book, All Our Neighbors, perched on the front desk, emphasizes the point. The stack of bulletproof vests in a nearby closet emphasizes how serious their work can be. So far, no responders have been harmed. Laub and Casey said they once had to dive behind a Hart minivan to avoid a drive-by shooting, but it wasn't related to their call. Responders rarely have to radio for emergency backup, and they've reported feeling safe after 99% of calls, one of many data points that program collects after each dispatch. When Durham Police Chief Andrews has publicly and privately supported Hart, she admitted that many patrol officers were initially skeptical, believing they'd have to constantly rescue amateurs. Some also chafed over the political fights that accompanied the program's creation. She said, there was this cloud that hung over the community safety department. And I've heard officers on the radio asking for Hart. So there is that change. And Smith said, now that we have a track record, more and more officers are seeing the value in it. Those are calls they would have had to go to, and they don't have to go to. In the program's first 10 months, HART teams have responded to calls for service more than 5,600 times, including follow-ups. But they're only scratching the surface of what the program could do. Each day, one community response team covers downtown and East Durham from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. Three co-response units work that same territory during weekday business hours. Program data said a fully staffed HART operating citywide and all day could have fielded 27,700 calls through May the 1st. At a February budget retreat, Durham City Council member Jillian Johnson proposed taking HART citywide 24/7, a more aggressive expansion than even Smith envisioned. Quote, I won't say there's anything we couldn't do, but I will say the expectation that in a year's time you could be fully staffed 24/7 would be an exceptionally high lift. Johnson's proposal had no price tag, but five of seven council members declared it a top priority. It was one of many priorities, however. Council members made $44 million worth of requests for this year's budget, up from $2 million in 2022, including a $10 million Marshall Plan to transform the long-neglected Hyte neighborhood, which Middleton said would be fully funded in the city manager's budget proposal. And Durham's property taxes are already high, which limits the potential for new revenue. As HART takes on more police responsibilities, Johnson thinks the police budget is a logical source of funds. Middleton says they should cross that bridge when the data suggests it's necessary. Gabriel Solis, the Alternative 911 Emergency Response Project Leader at Harvard School of Government Performance Lab, says other cities have avoided funding conflicts because their programs are new and small. That Harvard lab has helped 17 jurisdictions, including Durham, establish these programs over the last 2 years. In the absence of tension over scarce resources, alternative response programs have won widespread support, including from the police. And Solis says there's a strong consensus. The current system is really not adequately meeting the needs of residents in crisis. Also, for the most part, we've seen the police chiefs or sheriffs we're working with, they understand they don't need to be the default response to a lot of calls. A few cities established dedicated funding sources for unarmed responders. For example, a sales tax in Denver. But most programs are growing cautiously. Cities where they're expanding quickly are also spending big on their police. Durham's closest analog, Albuquerque, allocated $11.8 million to its community safety department, a 52% increase from 2022, while also budgeting its police budget by $32 million. It's unclear how sustainable that approach will be over the long term. As programs around the country mature, Smith believes that making HART's data public and inviting scrutiny from outside researchers will help develop best practices. He said, we want to be the best evaluated program in the country because we think it's important to build an evidence base to understand what's working and what's not. But Smith doesn't think HART needs to wait for the results of those evaluations to expand. He said, what we can already demonstrate in our pilot is there's a number of calls that we have been sending trained armed law enforcement officers to that can be safely diverted with at least similar outcomes. The studies will help them fine-tune their work, Smith continued, but he thinks they've answered the core questions. And given critical staffing shortage among Durham's police and paramedics, he said, if we can scale up this force and relieve that pressure, that's something we ought to immediately do. Several North Carolina cities have dipped their toes into the alternative response waters. Greensboro has co-responders, but is considering adding crisis teams. Apex, in Wake County, is considering a program. A crisis team inside Charlotte's police department responds to mental health-related 9/11 calls. Raleigh police have a mental health unit, though it primarily follows up after cops encounter an individual in crisis. None has taken it as far as Durham. That's another reason for publishing information on Hart's calls. If Durham can show that its program improves outcomes, saves law enforcement resources, and improves public safety, more cities will follow suit. Steve Shule, who was Durham's mayor when the Community Safety Department was created, said, Durham is already seen as a national model and other cities are just flocking here. Page, the city manager, did not respond to interview requests. It remains to be seen how large an expansion she'll propose for Hart next week, or how a city council fractured by personality conflicts and allegations of corruption will react. Diplomatically, Smith said his department will grow at the pace that's deemed appropriate by city leadership and the pace that we can fund because there's a lot of competing priorities. But community safety is the only city department with a yard sign campaign worthy of a well-known politician. Hundreds line streets and intersections around Durham. Smith finds that gratifying. The people that we live with, the neighbors we serve, hear what we're doing, have interacted with us, and would like to see that be made more available. That's a good indicator. It's not the only one that matters, but those yard signs are great. Well, I count that last story hopeful myself, and so I should go on to a dismal, depressing story now, but instead I'm going to stay with Durham and a story by Nina Musk about a workshop educating Durham residents about the city's tree canopy. As people arrived under the picnic shelter in Oval Park on Saturday morning by bike, car, and foot, they introduced themselves with their names and unusual identifier, the kinds of trees on their property. There was Tanya with a large oak that she decorates with string lights around the holidays. David and Elizabeth, who brought their crawling daughter Clara, tend to the loblolly pines, mulberries, oaks, and three-leafed maples in their front and backyards. Galia, who has an old willow oak on her property, said, I'm here because I want to learn how to be a better Lorax. The occasion? A free neighborhood event called Saving Our Tree Canopy, Walk and Learn Workshop. Organized by the Old West Durham Neighborhood Association and funded by the Duke Durham Neighborhood Partnership, the workshop educated attendees on tree and soil health, pruning, and extending the lives of older trees. As some of the oldest neighborhoods in the city, Old West Durham and neighboring Watts Hospital Hillendale, are home to many vulnerable mature trees. Fred Broadwell, 61, interim president of Old West Durham Neighborhood Association, told the Ninth Street Journal, that's the organization that published this article first, We've been seeing old oak trees cut down and limbs falling at a faster rate, and so there's concern, and to some extent fear, that the trees are becoming a hazard. With that issue in mind, the association organized Saturday's workshop with the tree care organization Leaf and Limb. Matt Archibald, 32, an arborist at Leaf and Limb, led the workshop. He told the group, It never ceases to amaze me how much life is within our yards and streets and parks. Trees are just amazing. After introduction, the group strolled toward a towering cluster of loblolly pines. There, they discussed the lifespan of urban trees. Many amateur gardeners believe street trees can only live to 75. But Archibald said, that's a rule made up by people who don't know trees. Most urban trees, he said, can live for more than 200 years, but unfavorable conditions cause stress and limit their lifespans. Quote, if we plant a tree and it's growing up in a really rough environment with people walking over it, poor soil and pruning, it's constantly going through some type of stress. That's why that tree will die. And he gestured to an oak tree down the block. Take a human example. If you're constantly stressed throughout life, you may not feel it every day, but over time that stress builds and builds, and maybe you have a heart attack way earlier than you would if you'd had less stress. Trees are the same way. The group attendees nodded. Later, the group traversed Oval Park to examine a freshly planted swamp white oak tree standing alone in the corner of the park. Birds chirped in the canopy overhead. As Broadwell explained, the tree was planted in honor of former Durham Mayor Steve Shule. The tree was young and appeared healthy to Archibald, but its lonely location was of slight concern. Trees are communal organisms, he said. They do best in their natural environment, in forests, where a lot of trees grow really close together. When a tree is planted on its own outside of its natural environment, it needs extra resources like compost, wood chips, and pruning to help it survive. Archibald said it's kind of like taking humans and throwing them underwater without any type of breathing equipment or safety nets. We need air, we need food, we need shelter. Taking a few extra steps to ensure that a tree is healthy can reduce the risk of fallen branches and limbs during storms. If we're pruning a tree every few years to keep it in good form and making sure the soil and structure are healthy, it's not going to fall on your house. We're taking care of it and being proactive about it, he said. In this way, caring for trees is a means of caring for people, too. Broadwell says, we don't want trees on people's houses. We don't want people to be afraid of their large trees. We want the air to be clean. There are so many good things that come from taking care of the trees that improve quality of life for residents. Broadwell hopes that attendees left the workshop with a more holistic understanding of tree health. Quote, I want people to get a much deeper understanding of the plants and insects and all the little things that go into a tree's urban ecology. For Archibald, whose left arm is covered in tattoos of ginkgo, Japanese maple, and other leaves, the workshop opened the door to allow others into his tree-filled world. And he said, smiling, to educate people on what I get to see every day is fantastic. It really has become my passion and purpose in life to talk about trees, to learn about them, and to have conversations like this. Well, now, you may have heard me speaking last week, or perhaps the week before, that the Indie Week and the Independent is being partnered with has a new organizational partner called The Assembly. That's a digital magazine that has been a friend of Indies since it launched in 2020. And this article is a Q&A. Jane Porter writes it, with the founder of Assembly, Kyle Villemain, about the differences between the Indie and the Assembly. They're going to be partners. These are some of the changes that we'll be reading in the Indie to come, which include things like perhaps the Indie turning all digital, as we know about expense of publishing. So, it opens up with this question. The Indie is a progressive outlet, and the Assembly is nonpartisan. What does that mean for Indie? Villemain says North Carolina is a big place, and it needs a lot of different voices. The Assembly and its long-form reporting will always be nonpartisan. That's non-negotiable for us. We believe that people in power do good and bad things regardless of ideology, and nobody gets a pass from tough and skeptical reporting. We know the Indy is a progressive outlet, and we respect that. There will be some stories the Indy publishes that will make me tear my hair out, and vice versa. It's good and healthy to have different perspectives at different outlets. Our focus will be on ensuring that the Indy's reporting is done at the highest level. The paper has to be a place that helps readers navigate where they live. That means local accountability and politics reporting, and a doubling down on arts, music, food, and culture. What should readers expect to be different from Indy? The Indy has to stop doing some things so that its team has time to do new things. We'll be making the painful but productive choice of moving from weekly print to every other week print. That will be the biggest change. Simply put, the Indy's team needs more time to focus on reporting and less scrambling to get out a weekly paper. You will also likely see a shorter daily newsletter, so that the Indy's terrific editor-in-chief has more time for editing and less spent on early morning newsletter writing. You'll see more food coverage, such as the Indy benefits from the Assembly's partnership with James Beard Award-winning food writer Hannah Raskin. You'll see more arts and music coverage, and you'll see more local investigative and accountability reporting. That's one partner. Are there other partners as well? We have two more partners coming to help besides Hannah's outlet, the food section. First, Scalawag magazine. Scalawag is a black-led and centering Southern journalism and storytelling organization. It had its roots here in Durham, but a presence across the South. Scalawag is making a really visionary investment in the Indy to help fund new reporting positions and ensure the Indy remains a forceful presence in Durham and the Triangle for years to come. Second, the Lenfest Institute for Journalism. The Institute is a pillar of the national journalism landscape with a long track record of driving change and sustainability for local news. Through its strategic advisory services, Lenfest Institute experts will provide pro bono help to the Indy's team as it reimagines itself. How could the print edition look different? What's the right product mix for our audience? How can our operations support a delightful experience for readers? Internally, how can we support and develop the team? The Lenfest Institute knows how to get results for readers, and it's a big deal to have them as a partner. What else should readers know? We're not doing this so the Indy can shrink. We'll have to make some tough cuts to stop the bleeding, but we have a plan to grow the Indy significantly by the end of the year. The Triangle needs more reporters out on the streets, and we think Indy can be the solution. It all depends on whether readers choose to give a few dollars a month to support the outlet, and whether local businesses and institutions decide that in supporting Indy's reporting and reaching the tens of thousands of Indy readers is part of their civic mission, or, of course, just their business mission. We'll be giving public reports in our newsletters every 2 months about how things are going. We'll give specific numbers so that readers know how their outlet is doing. Every dollar you choose to give through the Indy Week Press Club is another dollar that goes to reporters. And so as we get more information, that closes that article, you'll hear and read from their website, indyweek.com, and online what I can present to you. But I can already see the more and more of my articles on this weekly reading will be from the digital segment, because the print edition will shrink. And also we'll have to, here at NC Reading Service, get a paid subscription, if we don't already have one. I think we do. I know at home I'm a supporter. And we're coming up to the end of our broadcast time, so give me a moment to collect what data I can give you in the last minute or two I have. Well, I can see that I won't have time to really even give you outlines of the articles that I missed. Most of them are theater, literature, artistic related, but there are also a couple of hard-hitting ones about hate crime or hate neighbors in the Charlotte area in the print edition. But this last one talks about summer concerts in the Triangle area and mentions a few that are very worth looking at and supporting, going to for that matter. Duke's Music in the Garden series of 5 free concerts begins on June 7th. Rebecca Todd, Terrence Simeon, The Zydeco Experience, Melissa Carper, Christian Lopez, XOXOX, and long a fixture, The Music in the Garden for they call a fixture for third dates, music aficionados, and child-friendly picnics. And they will have some food vendors available. And let's see. Other summer concert series are heating up. Earlier this week, North Carolina Museum of Art announced that's in Raleigh. Its summer concert series, Shovels and Rope, Kenny G, Nickel Creek. Raleigh's Live After 5 music series is also back, with 3 more performances coming right up, May 17th, June 21, and July 19. And in Carrboro, Music Makers Freight Train Blues series runs Friday evenings through June the 23rd. And as for those music articles I was unable to get to today, Josh Ritter interviews and talks about Josh Ritter, Trey Charles, speeds into the music industry with a haunting sound and mindful message about slowing down. And music, Libby Rodenbaugh, Between the Blades, Political Arguments for Cosmic Inspiration. All those 3 music-related. Headlining the print edition was a story about college athletes who are making money off of endorsements. Could they be paid as university employees next? So lots and lots of information I was unable to deliver in my 58 minutes of broadcast time. As well as a new music release reviewed by Harris Wheelis, Joseph Terrell's solo debut, Landscape, which they say is awash in mystical sound and symbolism. Well, and speaking of symbolism, a giant red blinking symbol on my computer screen is telling me, John, it's time to close the broadcast. Make sure you make the announcements. Well, the announcements are that this show was available at ncreadingservice.org in the podcast section after our initial release of this on Friday afternoon. And I'll be back next week with the Indie Week broadcast. John Federson for the NC Reading Service saying so long, folks.